All right, and we've got, gosh, look at that. Just two lines left open right now. Hope you get a chance to get in there and ask your question. We're talking about birds, particularly raptors, and ongoing, a very thick vein in this book that runs through a discussion about prehistoric birds that have survived into present day. After all of them are dinosaurs, right? And that will be learned tonight with Jonathan Myberg, if you didn't know that already. But there's still lots of nuance in there and many areas we didn't get to. What questions do you have for him coming up next on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Well, I had heard that you were unsure that we could do 3 hours together on the air with your book. Is that true?
No, actually, I was worried that we weren't going to be able to get to enough on this.
Oh, good. Oh, glad to hear it, because this is where, I mean, you thought if I were taking you into areas that you weren't certain about, this is where that you really get challenges. This is often where calls turn into sort of like stump the guest. So
I am very stumpable, but I'll do my very best.
Okay, so gird yourself here. We'll start with the first-time caller line. Dakota is in Illinois on Coast to Coast AM. Dakota?
Hi, Ian.
Hi, you're talking with Jonathan Myberg. Go ahead.
Awesome. First of all, thank you for taking my call, Ian. Big fan.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Jonathan, I think your work is rather interesting, but I'm going to throw you, like Ian alluded to, I'm going to throw you a bit of a curveball. And I'm going to need you to stick with me on this.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there is a working theory that the modern birds that we see today are actually hyper-sophisticated government drones that
yes. on us. For... Yeah, I've heard about this.
Oh, okay. All right. So I don't have to explain too terribly much. Hopefully. Yeah,
well, how about me? I'm a little lost. So which birds are and which birds aren't real?
Unfortunately, that's a very good question. At this point, the technology is so sophisticated, it's very hard to tell.
Yeah, because what you're saying is the U.S. government drone technology is so sophisticated, it keeps pooping on my car.
Something like that, yeah.
Is that part of the illusion that they load up these bird drones so that they continue to strafe my car if I don't remember to put it in the garage?
Yeah, that's part of their blending in.
Okay.
Mimicking all the various functions that biological birds would.
Okay. So they're telling me there's somebody at an Air Force base somewhere that's going, okay, we're going over that car, going over the car. Drop it now. Okay. So
I don't know if it's that far, but
Dakota, do you believe this?
I'll be honest, looking into this, at first, like I'm sure you and many other listeners, at first, of course, I hold on, what? No, that
yeah.
sounds impossible, but excuse me. But looking into it, it's a CIA program. Take me forever to get a proper rundown, unfortunately, but
this is interesting. So, but even if they blended in some drones that look like birds, you could easily sell me on that. But the idea that all birds, that's nuts, right?
Right.
Okay.
And I personally don't believe all birds. What I've seen, what I've read, the CIA exterminated about 12 million birds between, I had it pulled up, I think it's 1957 to 1971 or so.
Okay.
Dakota, I can actually help you here, at least to some degree. And part of it is that this idea that the birds are government surveillance drones is actually quite literally a comedy project started by a college student. If you look up a site called birdsaren'treal.com, there's all kinds of merchandise and stuff associated with this, and it was meant as a joke on some other kinds of wilder theories. I think this student thought, like, what if I could just introduce this idea and see if it would gain any currency? Now, as for whether drones, though, could be made to mimic living things, you know, like tiny miniaturized drones that look a lot like insects, I think you'd might be much more likely to see something like that. To really fully mimic a living bird such that you couldn't tell the difference at a close range, it's very difficult to imagine that we're going to be able to do anything like that anytime soon. But I do think that drones are going to become more and more commonly used for all kinds of reasons, and it's not at all unlikely that that they'll probably make some to disguise them as living things in certain ways.
What was the name of the website again?
Birdsaren'treal.com.
Love that. I'm in on that after I get off the air. West of the Rockies, Jim is in Hollywood on Coast to Coast AM. Jim?
Yes, can you hear me, guys? How are you doing
yep.
tonight?
Very well. Go ahead.
Great, Jim. Great. Big fan. I was listening to the show last night, the Arthur Conan Doyle stuff. At first, very absurd, but at the end of the show, I have to say I was looking into it myself. So what am I saying?
Yeah, exactly. Go ahead. Yeah.
But I want to say, this is actually more of a question for Ian, I have to say. You were mentioning that, you had questioned the intelligence of chickens.
They're dumb.
And certainly I understand that to be a thing. But I guess my question is that isn't that like a dangerous kind of path to go down to where we have a certain, like, level of intelligence before it is like maybe ethical to eat something, especially with the possibilities of ever coming into another intelligent being from space or whatever, and maybe just your ideas on where our place in the food chain is when we're eating these dinosaurs.
Okay, anyway, you happen to catch me on a week when I've spent the entire week with a vegan diet all week long. I've been on a medically supervised fast. So there was no meat in my diet. I've been completely vegan, no dairy, no anything for 6 days. I can't wait to eat a chicken. I would eat a living chicken right now. I would just, I'm not sure that impulse of mine has anything to do with how smart it is. In fact, I defer that conversation to Samuel L. Jackson talking about pigs in with John Travolta, right?
It would have to be a very smart pig, right?
Have to be like Arnold Swiffle, like kind of a pig. So I have to say, it has nothing to do with intelligence that we eat chickens. I'm not eating them because they're dumb. I don't even eat them that much. I'm just saying, if we're talking about the brain size and evolution of chickens, let's just not pretend that. I mean, there's certain birds.
But let's not pretend that we didn't have a big part of possibly engineering chickens to be something that was not, quote unquote, natural. You know, we've
totally
put our foot in the middle.
I agree completely. I'm all about free range.
The wild ancestors of chickens are still living today.
Are they any smarter?
They may be. I mean, it's funny because, like, the wild ancestors of cattle no longer exist, but the wild ancestors of llamas do, and the wild ancestors of dogs do. But this question about consciousness is a really interesting one, about whether, if you want to make the decision that you don't want to eat something that's conscious, then you end up in trying to define what your theory of consciousness is, and is something dumb enough for me to eat it? Octopus are very, very smart. Am I going to not decide that I don't feel comfortable with eating calamari? Do I want to not eat things with a nervous system? And this is something everybody has to make up their minds about this. But trying to define consciousness is a really interesting subject. There's a book called Other Minds that I would recommend. That's about octopus and the deep origins of consciousness by the philosopher Peter Godfrey Smith.
Interesting.
That talks a little bit about this. And also there's a great essay by the writer David Foster Wallace called Consider the Lobster. He's trying to decide whether lobsters can feel pain or not, and whether that's something he ought to think about, whether he wants to eat one or not.
We'll go to Wildcard Line. Mike is in Colorado on Coast to Coast AM. Mike?
Good morning, Ian. Thank you so much for taking my call. And Mr. Myberg, great conversation tonight. You and Ian have done an absolutely outstanding job covering the full spectrum on this subject. I'm so impressed. So thank you so much. I just had a quick comment and question this evening. So, Mr. Myberg, when we look at when we talk about ancient cultures, you know, and how certain birds had symbolic meaning, and you know, both the Aztec and Mayan cultures, you know, these different birds represented a lot of different things to those civilizations. And you know, I was kind of curious to know about your thoughts on what certain birds, like the caracara, you know, meant to certain ancient civilizations and your research kind of regarding that aspect of this.
Oh, man, I'm so glad you asked this question because the book does go into this. The caracaras were a big visible part of the bird life of South America that people encountered as they walked into it. And unsurprisingly, they became very symbolically important. The Inca used feathers of a species called mountain caracaras that live in the high Andes. In the feathers that were worn in the Mascapaicha, which was the crown worn only by the Inca emperor. And as for the Aztecs, if you're familiar with the Mexican flag, you know, there's a picture of an eagle holding a snake perched on a cactus on it. That's derived from an Aztec legend of the bird that showed their ancestors, the Nahuatl, where to build Tenochtitlan, which became Mexico City, essentially. In the 1960s, a Mexican ornithologist named Rafael Martín del Campo put forward a theory that basically this bird was probably not an eagle as it's depicted, but was very likely a caracara, crested caracara, and that the Spanish had substituted an eagle because that was already the emblem of Habsburg Spain, so it was convenient for them to turn it into that.
Right.
But crested caracaras, there are eagles in Mexico, but only in the northern mountains, pretty far away from the Aztec heartland, and caracaras would have been everywhere, as they still are today. They're even in South Texas, people call crested caracaras Mexican eagles. And in Mexico itself, if you use the word águila, you could be talking about an eagle, or you could be talking about a caracara.
What does caracara mean?
As far as I know, caracara it sort of mimics the call of crested caracaras, which one person, they make a really weird call. One person compared it to the sound of a stick being dragged over a picket fence. It sounds like like that. And they tilt their heads back while they're making the sound. It's really striking. So it's kind of so that may be where the word comes from.
Sounds like Romulan or something, like something from Star Trek or something. Jay is in Texas, deep east Texas, on Coast to Coast AM on a wild card line for Jonathan Myberg. Go ahead, Jay.
Hey, this is I'm on Toledo Bend over here between Texas and Louisiana, and after the hurricanes came through, the twin hurricanes Katrina and Rita, I was on the lake. I was up here taking care of my brother and my mother, and I was on the lake. And one afternoon, I saw something flying over, and I said, it was really strange. I couldn't hear the engine. And all of a sudden, it flapped its wings. And this bird was about 2,000 feet, easily within 15 to 18 feet. And I came in, told my brother and my mother about it. And then the next afternoon, I was sitting out by the swing. We're about 25 yards from the lake. And I was explaining to them that I had seen this big bird. And all of a sudden, over the top of the trees, I saw a smaller bird fly in. And over top of that came in the Thunderbird. I'm going to go ahead and call it that. It had a wingspan of well over 15 feet, three times as big as an eagle. I could see eagles every day. But I have had five sightings during that period in 2005 in October of five different settings that I'd seen it with my brother twice. But I just wanted to...
I think that's fascinating. But Jonathan, what's he getting wrong? I mean, I accept that because it seems like he was sober and he had decent line of sight and maybe perhaps even some depth perception on... But where are you with that?
Well, I mean, I believe him that he saw something really unusual. And it, especially if after a hurricane, when all kinds of birds get blown around all over the place, so-called vagrant birds turn up in all kinds of funny places. In 2016, a bird called a Juan Fernandez petrel turned up in Phoenix, Arizona in the suburbs. This is a bird that breeds only on an island 6,000 miles away off of Chile.
Wow.
So as flying creatures, they get blown all over the place. It's not totally impossible that an albatross could have been blown over Louisiana. I mean, they have a wingspan of the largest ones of 11 or 12 feet. I've never heard of that, but it's not impossible. It could have been another kind of large raptor from, so it could have been a golden eagle, which do look quite a bit different from bald eagles and are a little bit bigger. The odds of something that's that large not being seen again multiple times by lots of people are pretty low, and extraordinary claims do require extraordinary evidence.
But I wonder whether, to Jay's point, it was kind of in a remote part.
Mm-hmm.
It's eating, and then after that, it could take off and head back south again, or wherever it is naturally inclined to go. You know, it doesn't mean that he stuck around and said, you know, I'm liking this a lot better. He just left.
That's true, but there are no known birds with a wingspan of 15 feet.
Right.
The largest flying birds, I've looked it up, and it's sort of a tie between Andean condors and Cinereus vulture, which is an African Eurasian species of vulture. And they're around about 10 to 11 feet. Now, if you saw that bird flying over your neighborhood, it would be extremely striking. I'm often really surprised, actually, when I've held birds in the hand, whether it's like a small songbird from a net or like one of these caracaras I've caught in the trap, at how much smaller they seem in the hand than they look when you're looking at them in flight. I don't know what it is about them that makes them look larger, but they just do. Sean McCann, a Canadian biologist I follow in the book, who studies this weird wasp-eating, group-living, red-throated caracara species that lives in the tropics, was astonished when he got them in a net in Guyana. And he said they were no bigger than a little American crow, but when he was watching them calling and dancing and yelling at him and being extremely dramatic, which they are, he had assumed they were twice as big as that.
Yeah, that's interesting. But that could also account for it. And it's also, there are genetic anomalies. And I'm not trying to say that 15 feet is a lock, but, you know, I've got a Boston Terrier. Boston Terriers are supposed to tap out at about 15 pounds. He's 40 pounds now. He was always big. He was, you know, it's like that time when whatever was encoded in the Boston Terrier comes out at just the oddest times, when two Boston Terriers, he was the only behemoth in the litter. And they're only supposed to live, you know, something we're in the area of 11 to 13 years, and he's pushing 16. And so I'm just saying there are those weird exceptions. And
variation within, there are giant humans, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's usually, as you say, a genetic anomaly. I've never heard of this happening in a bird, but nothing is impossible in that.
Yeah, but I think that's actually a better comparison, because in some ways we look at those as that's a result of a disease, of a thyroid condition. And that's where, you know, several of the current players in the NBA that came to us from like Serbia and other places around the world, that's what they have. And they've been able to monetize it quite well, and it helps make the series more interesting. But yeah, but their parents are normally sized, so why not that same thing for birds too? I love this show. Only a half hour left to go of your questions and comments next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And we're flocking to the phones. People are filling them up, and I love that for Jonathan Myberg. The book is so interesting. I believe in the first hour I described it as sort of like a summer beach read for bird nerds, but that's not fair. That would be only part of the market, because I've been reading this and I feel like I know so little about birds, and there are just so many of them around me that I actually try to spend a little bit of time when I'm outdoors trying to identify the sounds And then whatever I can see of the birds that are in the trees near my house, and I just don't have much luck. I have to get like binoculars and do the whole thing, and you just can't really do it justice with a book. But I can do it justice with this book, and I learned so much about the evolution of birds anyway, and you will too. You'll like it. You can link up to Jonathan through our website. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. Your final questions and comments. We'll start with the people who've been hanging on the longest next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. At the bottom of the hour break, I went to birdsaren'treal.com. That is an awesome website. I am laughing so hard at some of those T-shirts. And the idea that he's getting support on Patreon for that, too. UFO Jim on a wild card line in L.A. on Coast to Coast AM for Jonathan Myberg, a most remarkable creature. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, Ian, and hi, Jonathan. Just a few quick comments and a question. I think chickens are descended from Tyrannosaurus rex, and I think I heard that on a George Norrie show.
I'm not sure about that.
Half a year ago.
Let's get an answer to that question. Go ahead. Are chickens modern T rexes?
They're not direct descendants of the species Tyrannosaurus rex, but they are part of the same lineage of theropod dinosaurs that T rex was part of. I'm trying to think of a good analogy for that. In the same way that, I'm having trouble coming up with it exactly, but it's not that T-Rexes somehow slowly became chickens. T-Rexes died out. There are no more. Now, they might have lived on in Antarctica for quite some time after the Cretaceous extinctions, and we never know it. Or at least won't until the ice melts off. But right. there are no T-Rexes here now, and like most of the big meat-eating dinosaurs that were around at that time, they died after that time. But the lineages that survived from that group, which were probably small and could fly, included the ancestors of modern chickens.
Okay. Should we look at them like a sitcom spinoff? Like how...
Yes. Perfect.
Beverly Hillbillies created Green Acres, which then turned around and created Petticoat Junction.
The chickens are
the Petticoat Junction to the original T-Rex.
I was looking up the estimated population of chickens in the world, and it's something like 4 billion chickens estimated in the world today, I think.
Yeah. I believe that more than there are in Hooterville. That's for sure. Well, let's go to
23.7 billion. I'm totally wrong. 23.7 billion
chickens. Okay.
So, well, more than two chickens for every person.
Yeah. Well, then why? I mean, this again, I look at that and I go, well, I mean, I get why I've spent a week being vegan. I totally get that. But I mean, I also that's a lot of chickens. And at some point, it can't be good for the planet that there's so many chickens. Right.
No.
I mean, and I don't like the industrial farming. I like it free range, and I will insist on that. And I like grass fed and all of that too. But that's just a lot. That's a lot of chickens.
It is, and it takes a lot of resources to keep that many chickens alive.
That's like more chickens than there are ants. And I don't even look that up because I'm sure I'm wrong. But that's what it feels like. Daniel's in Laredo, Texas, on Coast to Coast AM on a wild card line for Jonathan Myberg.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So what came first, the egg or the chicken?
Well, or the dinosaur, which would be...
Right. Okay, so the question is, there's two things that I wanted to bring up observation-wise, two things. Well, biblically speaking, the Bible talked about Leviathan, this fire-breathing dragon, and it was around during the time when people were around, and it was in the book of Job. So looking at that, the earth is possibly 10,000 years old.
There were no fire-breathing dragons, right?
Well, the Bible says that. Leviathan.
Okay.
Well, hang on.
Yeah, I think you're mixing up a couple of things here.
What's the question, though? Huh?
Yeah, I think you're mixing up a couple of things, because Leviathan was a sea serpent.
Okay.
Right? It wasn't a fire-breathing dragon.
Well, you talked about the scales on him, that you couldn't even penetrate his scales in him.
Hence, they'll draw Leviathan out with a hook?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, but it was not a fire-breathing dragon. It does, the Bible does not say a Leviathan, a fire-breathing dragon, right?
Okay.
Okay, but I just want to be clear, because that's what happens, and then like a year later, someone comes and says, well, I heard it on Coast to Coast. Leviathan, I mean, this is the question, because I think Leviathan is where, if you brought up Leviathan and we were talking about Nessie, or we were talking about something like that, I think there's a closer to our one-to-one comparison about what the Bible says. But there were, you would think, right, Jim, that if there were T-Rexes running around gobbling people up, that would have raided a mention in the biblical text.
Okay.
Right?
So that creature wasn't around during that time then? And what about the earth being at least 10,000 years and how they say millions of years? I just don't understand how they can come up with something like that with this carbon dating and can determine that when no one was around even during that time. And then even like the Great Flood, how did any of these things survive even from the Great Flood if everything supposedly had died during that time?
Well, this is an interesting question. And I think actually, Jonathan, you address part of this in the book.
Yes. You're talking about Bernabe Cobo?
Yeah. And the idea that the Jesuit priest that was trying to reconcile all of this, right?
Yeah, he was having real trouble with it because he was in South America in the 1500s, and he wrote a history of the Inca Empire. But one of the things he kept noticing was that the animals in South America were different from the animals in North America, and different again from the animals in Europe. And the problem that he kept trying to reckon, and it wasn't just him, there were other people engaged in this, was trying to understand how, if all of the animals on Earth had somehow issued from Noah's Ark after Noah's Ark ran aground, which they thought was somewhere in the Middle East, how on Earth did they then get to South America and not be in other places? Why did they suddenly come to South America and stop? Why were there different kinds of animals in different places all over the world, and what kept them there? And wrestling with these kinds of questions was really, really difficult to tease out. And things like the movements of continents, it wasn't established that the continents themselves are sitting on giant plates that are moving until like the 1950s, 1960s. When Darwin died, this was not a known fact. When Darwin died, we didn't know about DNA yet. There are all kinds of things that intelligent people over the years have been wrestling with and have been wrong about. And one of the beauties of science, as I see it, not I'm more of like a science super fan than a practicing scientist, is its belief in its ability to be wrong.
Right.
Scientists have been very certain about things that they're wrong about, and we're very certain about things now that we will be wrong about in the future. But that's not a flaw in the system. That's its great strength to me.
Yeah. And I would take that from, let me approach that from a biblical perspective, because that's part of my background. And I would say the great strength of the Bible is it never pretends to be a book of science. Yeah. And it doesn't claim that. It doesn't say that. It's a book of truths, but not necessarily a book of facts. And that's why I think that's why some people get hung up on that idea, and why that Jesuit priest that you quote so eloquently in the book, as he's talking about coming to the terms of like, what would it mean? Well, it would mean that angels came and took species of tigers that were in one place, brought them over to the ark, had them survive on the ark, and then afterward, the same angels came back and took those tigers and put them back on the other part of the planet where they had originally come from. And he just couldn't get his mind around that.
I mean, the wonderful thing about the book of Job is that it's sort of like a play almost.
Right.
I mean, it's just sort of this dialogue, as you know, between
you talking about,
we're trying to understand why is there suffering in the world,
right,
and whether if someone who prospers in this world is necessarily automatically favored by God or not. And it doesn't really entirely answer that question.
No. In fact, what's even interesting is the way we tell the story of Job is completely different than the way the story of Job is told in the Bible, which is we talk about the patience of Job. He was never patient. He was angry. And he was angry from the get because his whole family had been wiped out. And in the end, he doesn't. All of his friends are saying, Job, ex-nay, don't
God
go in.
And die.
Right. Don't say you can't yell at God. And he's like, well, hell, I'm not going to die. Why? And so in the end, they have it out. And, you know, and God says, who are you to challenge me? And he's like, well, I'm the guy who just had his family wiped out because you had a stupid bet. And so he gets a prettier wife and new children. That's not a part of the story that people talk about, you know, unless you're in Hollywood, I think. And that's where they always like, it's a younger wife and more kids. And that's like, okay, you get a do-over. All right, we have another Daniel. This one's in Arkansas on Coast to Coast AM. I don't know that Jonathan can answer this question, but why not? Hey, Daniel.
Hey there. Jonathan, you and Ian should go on the road together.
Yeah.
You are hilarious.
He'd kick me out after, like, I'd be at the first Stuckey's. I'd be left on the side of the road. You had a question.
No, you're talking about science being wrong. Well, concerning the name of, why do we call a group or a flock of crows a murder of crows? Audubon Society still has an article up talking about don't call him a murder of crows. This is denigrating the honorable crow. Well,
oh,
who
really?
Hasn't been woken up in the morning by a freaking crow while they're
I'd murder him. Why? Yeah. So that is an interesting question about all the different ways in which we refer to flocks. What do we call a flock of caracaras?
I would say a mischief.
A mischief of caracaras. I like that. Roberta, in the time that we have, and we just have just a few minutes, west of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Roberta?
Well, good evening. Good morning, gentlemen. What an interesting topic tonight, being a student of paleontology myself.
Excellent.
So let's get back to reality instead of fantasy land, please. I was so excited when they found Apteryx in China with the feather impressions. And mm-hmm. I've seen photos of dinosaur skin. So, Jonathan, can you point me to other avenues besides Julia Clark that I can go look up and get images of any type of evidence of the feathers of dinosaurs?
Of dinosaur feathers. There's a great, the Thor Hansen wrote a book called Feathers, which goes into it goes into the evolution of feathers. But as far as images, unless I just run over to Google here and start looking, there have been so many fossil discoveries, especially in China, as you say, of feathered dinosaurs that have left these beautiful impressions of the feathers that they had. And in fact, even in studying the microstructures within those feathers and comparing them to microstructures within feathers of living birds, we've been able to deduce some things about what color they were. There even seemed to have been iridescent green and blue dinosaurs, feathered dinosaurs.
Hmm. Very interesting. James, first-time caller line in Philly on Coast to Coast AM and probably our last call for the night. Go ahead, James.
First, it is my Berg with a G, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. Second, the Cretaceous period, Mr. Myberg, we as humans, we do have the Cretaceous to thank for us being here. Is that true? I mean, if the Cretaceous extinction doesn't happen, we're not here. I mean, would we be here if it wasn't for that Cretaceous extinction?
I think it's quite likely that we would not be here if it were not for that. Because
we would not be here if it wasn't for the extinction.
Most likely not.
Okay, that's what I want. And second, I know we weren't focusing on them tonight, but I've always been fascinated with sharks. Are sharks a species unto themselves, or are there many species of sharks?
There are many species of sharks. There are many different lineages of sharks. They're very old, but some of them have sort of persisted in consistent forms over a really long time. There are some that are much newer. I mean, there are things like sleeper sharks and Greenland sharks that are just absolutely ancient lineages that even the individuals can be quite old. There's an estimate that it's possible that Greenland sharks could live as long as 500 years, which would make them, I think, the longest-lived vertebrate animals on the planet. They're a very diverse and thriving group, and there are hundreds of species.
Does that answer your question then, James?
Oh, yes, that definitely answers my question. Is your book available on audio form? I'm visually impaired. Is your book available on Audible or in kind of audio form? Will it be?
Yes, sir, it is, and I read it. It takes, if you want to hear me talk for 11 hours, that's the way to do it.
Oh, very good. Love that. Thank you, James. Appreciate that. And thank you, too, Jonathan. I think there, as you state, and there's it's so beautifully written when you talk about the full evolution of the Earth and the dependence of birds, but I never even really thought about the concept that maybe we should look at the meteor that hits the planet and ends the Cretaceous period. Maybe we should look at that as the Big Bang. I mean,
well,
really,
for our species, it was the catastrophe that made our world possible.
Yeah, I'd never thought about that, and that's such an interesting concept that even in the way in which, I mean, again, if we talk about that first, there was nothing. And so for human beings, there was nothing before that meteor hits. And then there was something, and you filled in some really interesting blanks and started great conversations. And I hope you had a terrific time, because I know I'd love to have you back sometime.
No, Ian, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you, and thanks to everybody who called in and had questions. I really appreciate all of them.
And I'm going to go unwind listening to the music of Shearwater, and I'll try and
use
that as a bumper coming up in the weeks ahead, too. Love it when our guests are multi-talented like that. And to you and to everybody out there, you know, Father's Day is approaching. Don't forget Dad on the way. And I won't speak to you again until July. Getting hotter fast in the Southwest, where I used to live. This is an ongoing conversation we should be talking more and more about, is what's going to happen if we're heating up to 120 degrees in the Southwest in June. So everybody stay cool until we find each other back again. In the meantime, Deus Tiamat, and I do too.